Welcome back to the Republican Professor. The mask mandate, what happened to it? The Biden rule? Well, it got struck down. If you don't know, it was a Trump-appointed judge. We covered it the last episode. Check it out. A couple of episodes ago was the first of those. And the first part, we're continuing going through Catherine Kimball Mizell's judgment. I'm just letting you know, I'm reminding you constantly that the mask mandate was not rescinded because it was bad policy, because it was illegal, what that because it was unwise, because it was overbearing, because it was ridiculous. It wasn't rescinded because of a mass popular revolt by mask wearers in their cars. In Democrat land, the mask mandate was deemed illegal because a Trump-appointed judge, Catherine Kimball Mizell, struck it down throughout the whole land. And she was very young when she was appointed. She was 36. That's very young for a federal judge. And we're on page 24. And, if you find this to be boring, well, I guess I could maybe understand that perspective, but somebody's got to stay awake and pay attention to this stuff. And you have a right to vote if you're an American citizen and you're a certain age. And I've discovered that with American citizens, the right to vote comes with a certain arrogance that all of a sudden you're an expert on something, even though you have attention span of a like an ant. And well, I guess I'll keep my California hat on, because that's we're pushing back here on the crazy system here, trying to bring some health to this thing. You're going to have to put some elbow grease into this if you take your voting duty and right privileged, and I say privileged not as opposed to right, because there's the privileges and immunities clause in the Constitution that refers to rights, FYI. Privileges and rights mean the same thing. In the Constitution. You're going to have to start taking this seriously because you have a huge government. It's huge. It's absolutely huge. And your congressman, their job is to represent you to the federal government. Well, how are you going to know who to choose for that to represent you to the federal government if you don't know what the heck the government is doing? You don't even know examples. You've never done a deep dive on even one example. We're doing a deep dive. We're doing several deep dives. So you know what a deep dive even looks like. The government disagrees. They want to keep the mask mandate. I'm on page 24, asserting that subsection A.
Well, what are you talking about? Aren't you gonna summarize it?
You have calories you can burn in your finger. Go find the previous episode that where we talked about it. Push play and listen and take notes. I'm not going to do everything for you. Get off your lazy beep and pay attention. I'm on page 24. The government disagrees, asserting that subsection A gives it a power to regulate persons traveling in interstate commerce. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The government, Biden administration, paid millions of dollars to defend this in court and to enforce it. And by the way, demanded that private companies pay millions of dollars to enforce it on their behalf. That's a hidden tax. How many minutes of employee time just on airlines alone were stewardesses going around, scurrying around, going, bring your mask up above your nose. Bring your mask up above your nose. You can't have it. You've been eating too long. I've been watching. That's too long of a drink. Is there even any liquid in there? There's not even any liquid in there. And that's private money. That's private company that the government is telling. Kimball's saying the whole time it was illegal. It was illegal the entire time. That mask mandate. It was illegal the entire time. It should have never been issued. Trump appointment. For the reasons explained above, the court is not persuaded. Thank God. The Trump-appointed judge is not persuaded. Subsection A refers to direct impositions on property, while subsections B through D contemplate direct restrictions on individual movement. As discussed above, section 264B through D give the CDC power to directly regulate individuals only if they are traveling into the United States from abroad or are reasonably believed to be infected with a communicable disease in a qualifying stage. The CDC's mask mandate extends to city bus terminals, ride-sharing services, not just to individuals coming into a state or possession from a foreign country, and it applies to all persons in an airport without any finding that any individual is reasonably believed to be infected with COVID-19. All of these cost impositions, not only with tax money, but with private money that consumers are paying for and business owners are paying for, passing it on to consumers. And yet, without any finding that any individual is reasonably believed to be infected, as required by the statute. Chevron deference, page 25. Now, this is dated because this is from, well, 2.5 years ago, filed April 2022. April 2022. And since then, Chevron deference has taken a full frontal hit. Boom. In the Loper Bright decision, which we're going to cover on the podcast, Lord willing. Send in your gifts and donations at Republican Professor on Venmo. Send it in. Send me a message. Ask how you can support the podcast, the project. Chevron deference, page 25. It really helps, keeps us going. Finally, the government invokes Chevron deference, arguing that even if its reading of Section 264 is not the best one, the court should adopt it anyway. Chevron deference requires that courts defer to an agency interpretation of a statute that the agency administers when the statute is ambiguous and the interpretation is reasonable. But a court defers only if a statute is ambiguous after the court uses all the traditional tools of statutory construction. There's an interesting story with Chevron, the way it came about, and its demise this past year. And it involves the Gorsuch family. Gorsuch's mother was the head of the EPA who won that case. I'm gonna tell the story because her son overturns that Republican victory in Chevron. The Reagan administration won that case, and Gorsuch's mother was part of the Reagan administration at that time. Her son was watching that, became an attorney, and developed deep concerns about that, and then was very instrumental in overturning it, basically reversing it. So that's a story of Republican mistake and Republican fixing mistake. Republican identifying mistake, fixing mistake. That's a great Republican story right there. Loper Bright. Chevron versus Loper Bright. Send your gifts in so I can do this, for God's sake. Punch those numbers in. But a court defers only if a statute is ambiguous after the court uses all the traditional tools of statutory construction. A court may not rest on Chevron to avoid rigorous statutory analysis. You know that a court has not applied, the Supreme Court has not applied Chevron deference since 2016. Coming up, I can't wait for that one. I cannot wait. I'm on page 26. Kettle One. As explained above, the statute is not ambiguous. Congress addressed whether the CDC may enact preventative measures that condition the interstate travel of an entire population on adherence to CDC dictates. It may not. It may not. So that is the end of the matter. Nor is the government's interpretation a reasonable one. To be reasonable, an interpretation must account for the specific context in which the language is used and the broader context of the statute as a whole. The government here advances a reading of sanitation that untethers it from the surrounding words and the statutory structure. Such an interpretation does not merit deference. Accordingly, Chevron deference does not apply. Well, Chevron deference is gone now, so praise God. Although there's still going to be problems, and we'll have to talk about that when we talk about Chevron deference. I'm sorry, are you learning something here? I'm sorry. Is it painful? Are you thinking, I don't know what he's talking about? Well, you don't know what I'm talking about because you don't know what I'm talking about. And that's the whole point of watching this and learning. Apply yourself. The whole point of recalling this to Republican Professor is that the viewer needs to bring something to the experience. It's not a passive receptivity where you're like, oh, what's this over here? No, I expect you to engage the material. And I'm not going to babysit you and coddle you and put all sorts of little bells and whistles and this and this and this and this and this and this. And then, cartoon over here and this over here and some music maybe, just to try to keep, I'm not going to do that. You know why? Because I'm an adult. And it's about time you had an adult in your life, for God's sake. You should be embarrassed if you can't pay attention. I mean, I would be embarrassed if I were you. Well, let's keep going. This is good stuff. Page 26. But only one T, so don't get too excited. There is an independent bar to the government's invocation of Chevron, the major questions doctrine. The government's interpretation. I see. No, if I was listening to this and I didn't know what that was, I would write it down. That's me. I'd write it down and I would, pay attention. Try to learn it. The government's interpretation is untenable because courts expect Congress to speak clearly if it assigns decisions of vast economic and political significance to an administrative agency. The CDC asserts that such a power, sorry, the CDC asserts such a power in the mask mandate. But Section 264A is far from such a grant. The government interprets sanitation and other measures to include traditional techniques that impede the spread of disease. One definition it relied upon is even broader, defining sanitation as the applying of measures for preserving and promoting public health. Wow, that encompasses everything. If Congress intended this definition, the power bestowed on the CDC would be breathtaking. There's a reductio ad absurdum argument. That means that reduces to absurdity that way, therefore we are permitted and even required logically to go back in the argument and reject what led to the absurdity. That's the form of a reductio ad absurdum argument. And if I was you, I'd be writing it down. Write it down.
No, I can remember. I can. What's this over here?
It certainly would not be limited to modest measures of sanitation like masks. Let's go back. One definition it relies upon is even broader, defining sanitation as the applying, this is a quote, applying of measures for preserving and promoting public health. That would be almost anything. It's so vague. If Congress intended this definition, the power bestowed on the CDC would be breathtaking. Yeah, that's absurd. That's an absurd result. I know some of you Democrats are thinking, sounds great. I love a breathtakingly powerful CDC. As long as we're in charge, we like it. And it certainly would not be limited to the modest measures of sanitation like masks. I mean, they would ban guns based on that definition. applying measures of preserving and promoting public health. You think I'm kidding? They want gun control based on public health. They shut down businesses based on public health. I mean, there's any number of violating economic rights. They would probably violate your right to counsel, your right to confront witnesses, your right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, your right to you're I mean, they already prevented you from going to church. Your right to be free from excessive fines, cruel and unusual punishments. It's happened before in tyrannical situations. It would also justify requiring that businesses install air filtration systems to reduce the risks from airborne contagions, or install plexiglass dividers between desks or office spaces. And we know those plexiglass dividers saved lives. So too, that was being sarcastic in case you didn't know. So too, a power to improve sanitation would easily extend to requiring vaccinations against COVID-19, the seasonal flu, or other diseases. I'm on page 27. Filed April 18th, 2022. U.S. District Court, Middle District of Florida, Tampa Division, Health Freedom Defense Fund Incorporated versus Joseph R. Biden in his official capacity as P. Resident of the United States. Or to mandatory social distancing, coughing into elbows, daily multivitamins. In short, the sheer scope of the CDC's claimed authority under Section 264A would counsel against the government's interpretation. But arguments about what the CDC might require in the next pandemic or COVID-19 variant are hardly necessary. The power it claims here is sufficient. The government's interpretation of 264A permits the CDC to impose preventive health measures on sick and healthy individuals alike who have even attenuated connections to interstate travel. Under this reading of 264A, the CDC claims a power to regulate how individuals behave in such diverse places as airplanes, train stations, marinas, and personal vehicles used in ride-sharing services across town, along with the power to require that owners, operators, and employees of transit facilities use their best efforts. Again, how do you measure that? That wasn't your best effort. It's pretty good, but it wasn't your best. Therefore, penalty to enforce the CDC's commands on the public. And all this with the threat of civil and criminal penalties, or at a minimum, ejection. I almost thought that said something else for a second. Ejection from the conveyance or transportation hub. Oh, this is astounding. Okay, we have a commercial break. Sorry, we have to pay the bills. I gotta read a commercial. Have you ever wanted to buy something or ever needed to buy something? Try going to a store. Don't have to go on the internet to look for a store. You could just go down the street, either by walking, taking a car, or public transit. Some people take a skateboard to a store. Stores come in a variety of shapes and sizes and a variety of products that you may or may not need. The products are usually there for you to look at and purchase at a register, POS, point of sale. So if you need something and you have some money, try going to a store. All right. Got to pay the bills around here. Moreover, I'm on page 28. As the mask mandate acknowledged, it has a significant effect on the economy. The mandate is a major rule under the Congressional Review Act and an economically significant regulatory action. These labels mean that the mandate is likely to have either an annual effect of 100 million or more on the economy. Oh my gosh. A major increase in consumer prices or significant adverse effects on the economy. That's 5 U.S. Code Section 8042 defining a major rule. Wow. All told, this is no everyday exercise of federal power. Think I'm wasting your time with this stuff? The government purports to discover this unheralded power to regulate how individuals appear and behave in public in a long extant statute over one over 70 years old. Courts greet such discoveries with a measure of skepticism. To date, this provision has rarely been invoked and never before to justify a mandate that travelers on every form of commercialized travel wear masks. This is really nice to read because I remember thinking, this seems really extreme. And she's saying, it is. It's virtually unheard of. It may be unheard of.
Well, COVID-19 was unheard of.
Yeah, I heard that one before. I heard that one before. And then I saw that there was very little careful attention paid to whether someone was dying with that disease or dying because of it. And that distinction was blurred in many reports that I saw when I was just looking for facts. And I also saw that facts, or at least reports that purported to be facts, were censored. So, what's the truth if you're censoring? How do we get to the truth in posterity? Am I supposed to get it through the mail? I wouldn't mind. I wouldn't mind, but it would be expensive because of inflation. So to this date, I'm on page 29. I'm just quoting the court's decision. To this date, this provision has been rarely been invoked and never before to justify a mandate that travelers on every form of commercialized travel wear masks. Perhaps the most notable use of the statute so far, excluding the last 2 years, of course, was a decision to ban small turtles due to a risk of salmonella. And when Congress passed the statute in 1944, it did so to codify the federal government's historic role in quarantine. It was not a fount of new power. The history suggests that the power the government sees in Section 264A is a mirage. And yet, in this statute, the CDC finds a power over public health that was traditionally understood and still is understood as a function of state police power. Page 30. Historically, public health matters have been regulated at the state level by authorities who enjoy broader and more general government powers. Courts often decline to defer to agency interpretations that would permit federal encroachment upon a traditional state power. That is so because it is an ordinary rule of statutory construction that if Congress intends to alter the usual constitutional balance between the states and the federal government, it must make its intention to do so unmistakably clear in the language of the statute. Section 264A has no unmistakably clear language indicating that Congress intended for the CDC to invade the traditionally state-operated arena of population-wide preventative public health regulations, or that Congress intended to delegate a decision of such economic and political significance to an agency in so cryptic a fashion as to tie it to sanitation. Because it exceeded the authority granted in Section 264A, the court must hold unlawful and set aside the mask mandate as an agency action that is not in accordance with law, is in excess of statutory jurisdiction and short of statutory right. Because the court agrees with plaintiffs that the mandate exceeds the CDC's statutory authority, does not need to reach the plaintiff's alternative non-delegation claim. And that would be a harder claim. B, on page 31, the mask mandate improperly invoked the good cause exception to the notice and comment rulemaking. The APA requires that agencies provide an opportunity for the public to review and comment on upon a new rule before it becomes legally binding. The agency must publish a notice in the Federal Register that includes reference to the legal authority under which the rule is proposed, and either the terms or substance of the proposed rule, or a description of the subjects and issues involved. Following publication, the agency must give interested persons an opportunity to participate in the rulemaking through submission of written data, views, or arguments. This comment period must be at least 30 days. Finally, the agency must consider and respond to significant comments received during the period for public comment. How's that enforced? Must consider. How do you enforce considering comments? And how do you enforce responding to significant comments? Doesn't say all significant comments. This process is known as notice and comment. It permits interested parties to criticize projected agency action before that action is embedded in a final rule and allows the agency to benefit from the party's suggestions. I'll tell you what it does. It puts in statute your constitutional right to petition the government for a redress of grievances. And your grievances, if you publish this rule, it's going to affect me. And I'm telling you, I'm petitioning right now. Don't do it. You have a right to do that. You already have a constitutional right to do that. This is a statutory form of that right. It's channeling that right toward the agency in a productive matter. That's the idea. But I mean, when you have tens of thousands of comments, how do you know which one is significant? How do you know if the agency took sufficient consideration of the best comments? How do you even know what the best comments are? I mean, how do you enforce this? Let me guess. You get a commission to look at this, and then how do you know if the commission is doing a good job? Well, you have an accountability office that watches the commission. Well, how do you know if the accountability office is doing a good job? Well, you're going to create an agency that oversees that accountability office. You see the problem, right? Ultimately, if you're not engaged in this as a voter, we're screwed. And that's why I'm so hard on you guys today. And I actually feel bad for people that have no attention span. I feel sad that that's a bad life. It's not a good life. Sometimes people have it because of circumstances beyond their control, like small children. Or a crappy job situation. If it's in your control, you should fight back against it. Your country depends on you. So this notice and comment period, it permits interested parties to have a say. It also attempts to provide a surrogate political process to constrain the exercise of legislative power that Congress has delegated. Don't like that term, to an otherwise undemocratic and unaccountable rulemaking process. Notice she doesn't consider the non-delegation claim. That's a claim, that's a question of whether Congress can possibly delegate legislative power to the executive branch. That's a hard question that she wanted to avoid, and she did avoid it. Page 32. The CDC did not allow for public participation through notice and comment before issuing the mask mandate. Accordingly, promulgation of the mandate violated the APA unless an exception to the ordinary rulemaking procedure applies. Despite its importance, the APA provides narrow exceptions to notice and comment. Two of those exceptions are relevant here. The first is when an agency action is not a rule. The second is when the agency properly invokes good cause to forego notice and comment. Page 32. The mask mandate improperly invoked the order and interpretative rule exceptions to the notice and comment. The APA's notice and comment procedures apply only to agency rule making. 5 USC Section 553B, which is the process of making a rule of general or particular applicability and future effect. It does not apply to case-by-case adjudication, which results in an order. Welcome to administrative law. Don't check out. Don't check out. Pay attention. It's important. Nor does it apply to an agency's interpretive rules or general statements of policy, neither of which are binding on the public. We're on page 33. Although the mask mandate itself claims that it is not a rule within the meaning of the APA, you have to be kidding me. I mean, you just listen to this. The mask mandate itself claims it's not a rule. Have you read 1984? The government abandoned that untenable position on review. The mask mandate is a generally applicable standard governing conduct and rights. Yeah, everybody that sat on an airplane and had a stewardess come up and say, "Don't call me stewardess. It's office manager." But, can you, put it above your nose? And I was like, I don't breathe through my nose. I breathe only through my mouth. So you have to put it above your nose. Well, I'm gonna take some chips now. I'm gonna eat some chips. This chip. And there was no rule about how long it took to eat a chip or how big the chip had to be. You could put it in little bites. Oh, that chip. Oh, that's 100th of that's 1/100th of a chip. I got 99 more just for that one chip. Yeah, we got around that one. Thus, it is clearly a rule subject to the notice and comment procedures required by the APA. Accordingly, the sole question is whether the CDC had good cause. Two, the mask mandate improperly invoked the good cause exception to the notice and comment rulemaking. Page 33. Notice and comment does not apply when the agency for good cause finds and incorporates the finding in a brief statement of reasons. Therefore, the rule issues. In the rules issued, that notice and public procedure thereon are impracticable, unnecessary, or contrary to the public interest. The mandate invoked this exception to forego notice and comment. Aren't all rules supposed to be in the public interest? And that would mean that it's contrary to public interest if we don't have it. I just, the mandate invoked. So first they're saying the mandate is not a mandate, even though we see it is, and it costs the economy a huge amount of money. It makes a huge difference with in people's lives. It costs taxpayers money. And now they're saying the mandate invoked this exception to forgo notice and comment because they didn't want to hear your comments. They didn't want to hear your stupid comments. So just shut up and do what we tell you to do. That's what they were saying. So the court must determine, and when she says the court, she means a Trump-appointed judge must determine whether this Biden administration bullcrap is going to fly. Wouldn't it be great if she said that? I would be great. So the court must determine whether a 30-day notice and comment period was impracticable, unnecessary, or contrary to public interest. Well, it was contrary to them forcing their will upon you. Hearing your opinion was contrary to them forcing their will upon you. The exception is to be narrowly construed and only reluctantly countenanced. Okay, that's from case law. Page 34. The onus is on the agency to establish this finding. Thank God. If the Democrats were in charge, the burden would be on the plaintiffs, the people. That's you, not the government, because they don't want the government to have the burden when it comes to them forcing their rules on you. Specifically, the APA requires that an agency invoking good cause incorporate its finding and a brief statement of reasons why it believes notice and comment is impracticable or contrary to the public interest. Courts do not defer to the agency's conclusion on good cause. The court's review of the CDC determination that good cause exists is limited to the grounds that the agency invoked when it took the action. The court may not supply a reasoned basis for the agency's action that the agency itself has not given. The mandate asserted that there was good cause to dispense with prior public notice and comment, meaning they didn't want to hear from the democracy. This whole election has been preserving democracy. Remember that bullcrap that they were saying? Our democracy is threatened. Remember that? Remember the J6 stuff? They were so concerned about the democracy being threatened. And then they turn around and they say, we're going to impose, this is just one example, orders on people, on businesses, at taxpayer expense and at private expense that impinge on individual liberty in multiple ways, not to mention are just annoying and nuisance. And we don't want to hear what you have to say about it, democracy. Just shut up. Just shut up. That's what they're saying. Just shut up. We're in charge. This is a rule. You do it. Oh, it's not a rule. As soon as they're challenging court, oh, it's not a rule. That's remember that's and now they're oh, okay, it's a rule. Okay, we have good cause to avoid notice and comment. The statute requires notice and comment by people. The democracy, the people are in charge. That's what democracy means in Greek. Demos means people. The mandate asserted that there was good cause to dispense with prior public notice and comment because Given the public health emergency caused by COVID-19, it would be impracticable and contrary to the public's health. And by extension, the public's interest to delay the issuance and effective date of this order. This is page 35 of the decision. This statement, without more, is insufficient to establish good cause to dispense with notice and comment. Wouldn't you have to provide some scientific evidence that that's true? How do you know that this is a good remedy? Ordinarily, I think you'd find out that out from notice and comment. The mandate's explanation, a single conclusory sentence, does not carry its burden to show strong enough reason to invoke the good cause exception. A mere recitation that good cause exists does not amount to a good cause. That's quoting a prior case law. Nor does it allow the court to ensure that the CDC engaged in reasoned decision making. The only reason the mandate cites is that, quote, the public health emergency caused by COVID-19, unquote. That's all they did to cite. That was their evidence. There was no scientific evidence that this rule would help. They just stated, this is what my students do when I ask for an argument, and they just give me the conclusion. It's almost like they don't even know what an argument is. An argument is never a just one sentence. An argument has to have at least two sentences, at least one premise that purports to provide support for another sentence, which would be the conclusion. That's just the definition of an argument. You learn that in my first week of logic when I teach logic. That is certainly support for the promulgation of the mandate, but good cause to suspend notice and comment must be supported by more than the bare need for the regulations, meaning these regulations. And COVID-19 itself does not always justify an agency bypassing notice and comment. Instead, the agency must, page 36, identify specific reasons why there was good cause for dispensing with the usual notice and comment requirements in the particular environment the agency intended to regulate. The mandate does not do that. Nor does the mandate explain why a delay for public comment was contrary to the public's interest. Of course, delay, at least 30 days, is inherent in public comment, but the APA presupposes that participation from the regulated public produces benefits that outweighs the costs, at least in the ordinary course. Besides its brief reference to the pandemic, the mandate makes no effort to explain its reasoning that there was an exceptional circumstance at the time it implemented the rule. The mandate's terse conclusion contrasts markedly with another regulation that addressed the COVID-19 pandemic and invoked good cause to forgo notice and comment. When the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, mandated that the staff of healthcare facilities receiving Medicare or Medicaid funding be vaccinated against COVID-19, It provided almost 4 pages of reasoning with 40 footnotes of supporting sources on why there was good cause to forgo notice and comment. Page 37. CMS identified specific reasons to dispense with notice and comment that it supported with detailed explanation on the urgency presented by the ongoing pandemic, the outbreaks associated with the Delta variant, and the oncoming influenza season. CMS also provided an estimated cost in human lives from the delay in issuing a vaccine mandate. The Supreme Court concluded that this extensive reasoning properly invoked the good cause exception. She's saying you want to take a look at Alito's dissent in that Missouri case. That'd be 142 Supreme Court at 653, the Missouri case. And Alito was reasoning for four justices. So that's an interesting case. I'm going to take a look at that. I'm going to make a quick note really quick. I might want to chase that down. All right. The mandate fares no better when compared to non-COVID-19 related regulations that invoked good cause. Courts have found longer and more detailed assertions of good cause deficient. EPA lacked good cause despite the rule's four reasons to dispense with notice and comment and eight paragraphs of explanation. And that was in a Mack Trucks case. And short or conclusory claims of good cause often fail. Page 38. This is undergraduate level stuff. This is undergraduate level mistakes the government is making. Meaning, you turn your paper in and the question is, explain your reasoning and you give like one sentence and it's a major part of the grade. It's like, hello, what type of household did you grow up in? I don't know. Must have been neglected as a kid, because you should know better. The regulations that succeed often contain detailed and careful explanations of the agency's reasoning. The CDC's failure to explain its reasoning is particularly problematic here. Yeah, this paper is worth 30% of the grade. At the time when the CDC issued the mandate, the COVID-19 pandemic had been ongoing for almost a year, and the COVID-19 case numbers were decreasing. By the way, what's a case number? Is that somebody that has symptoms? Or is it something else? Is it somebody that's sick? Or is it something else? This timing undercuts the CDC's suggestion that its action was so urgent that a 30-day comment period was contrary to the public interest. So, too, the CDC's delay in issuing the mandate further undercuts its position. The CDC issued the mandate in February 2021, almost 2 weeks after the president called for a mandate, 11 months after the president had declared COVID-19 a national emergency, a different president, that was President Trump, and almost 13 months since the Secretary of Health and Human Services had declared a public health emergency. Trump never issued a mask mandate. This history, on page 39, suggests that the CDC itself did not find the passage of time particularly serious. Nor did the CDC explain its reason for the delay. To be sure, the CDC needed time to deliberate on its proposed rule. Ordinarily, some of that deliberation occurs during the 30-day notice and comment period. Instead, the CDC here spent approximately 2 weeks considering and drafting the mask mandate after the president called for it, since an agency need publish only a description of the subjects and issues involved, not a complete rule. The CDC and the public's deliberation process could have partially overlapped. So, providing for notice and comment may have added only another 2 weeks. That's too much for Democrats who don't care what you have to say. In the name of democracy, or the CDC could have issued the mask mandate as a binding interim rule and allowed intermediate notice and comment, immediate notice and comment on a final version. Of course, the CDC was not required to do any of this or to consider all the policy alternatives in reaching its decision, but the availability of these alternatives undermines its conclusion that it had good cause to forgo notice and comment due to the dangers of delay. Even more so, since the mandate does not address why these common sense approaches, which may have required minimal or no additional delay, and certainly would have allowed interested persons to an opportunity to submit their views, were indefeasible or contrary to the public interest. Finally, the mandate's failure to explain is especially troubling because the benefits of public comment were at their zenith. First, the mandate governs the conduct of private individuals and their daily lives. More expansive the regulatory reach, of course, the greater the necessity for public comment. Second, the public has a heightened interest in participating in a regulation that would constrain their choices and actions via threats of civil and criminal penalties. When the consequence of an agency rulemaking is to make previously lawful conduct unlawful, that is to say, innocent conduct criminalized, and to impose criminal, that was page 40, sanctions, the balance of these competing policies imposes a heavy burden upon the agency to show public necessity. Though the CDC did not intend to rely primarily on them, it reserved the right to enforce the mandate through criminal penalties. Wasn't a rule, though. Federal statutes provide that an individual who violated or violates or disregards regulations issued under Section 264 may be fined $1,000, imprisoned for up to a year. Wow. Or fined and imprisoned. That's 42 U.S. Code Section 7271A. Federal regulations similarly provide for a potential year of imprisonment for violators, but more strongly encourage widespread voluntary compliance by providing for fines up to $100,000 if the violation does not cause a death, and up to $250,000 if it does result in death. What if it results in the death of your business? Can you fine the government? You're just being, that's called individualism. That's it. That's an individual. You're an individualist. Applying these provisions, DHS protocols provide for a $500 to $1,000 fine for first-time offenders and 1 to 3 grand for repeat offenders. I remember walking on Monterey, a beach in Monterey, the histrionic signs, Pacific Grove, Asilomar Beach. I mean, on the wharf, $100 fine for no mask. You're right on the damn beach. And as soon as the sun was going down, people started taking their masks off because it was less dangerous at night. It's the sun that causes the virus. Yeah. DHS also clarifies that these penalties are separate from any civil penalties, and the FAA may impose that the FAA may impose for unruly and unsafe behavior. Wow. I guess there's a report of like 1900 to 2500 unruly passengers that didn't want to have their masks on, and they were fined under that. Finally, especially in the context of health risks, page 42, notice and comment procedures assure the dialogue necessary to the creation of reasonable rules. Despite the public interests involved, the availability of alternatives, and the timing, the mask mandate makes no effort to show the impracticability of affording notice and comment, or that doing so was contrary to the public interest. Nor is the mandate invocation of good cause sufficient for the court to find that the CDC engaged in reasoned decision making when it found good cause. You guys, this is like the most basic thing. You have an impartial adjudicator, the judge, and it should be a judge, an Article 3 judge, appointed by President Trump, confirmed by the Republican Senate. And she's saying this is not even close to reasonable in decision making. You may have prevented notice and comment from the public, but now you're getting my notice and comment. And the Republican professor is reporting on it for posterity. It's going to be a permanent record. The government resists this conclusion, arguing that the CDC mandate made a common sense finding based on the record that delaying the mandate would do real harm because it would lead to increased COVID-19 transmission. Perhaps so. But as explained above, the CDC failed to articulate that reasoning or connect its finding, if it did so, to the record. Not that hard. You ever heard of a stapler?
But I turned it in. I turned it in.
Turned it in, huh? I see. The court may not offer those findings for the agency. The court accepts the CDC's policy determination that requiring masks will limit COVID-19 transmission and will thus decrease the serious illnesses and death that COVID-19 occasions. But that finding by itself is not sufficient to establish good cause. If the existence of a communicable disease alone permitted the CDC to find good cause, then CDC would seldom, if ever, need to comply with notice and comment. That's a reductio ad absurdum yet again. And the COVID-19 pandemic does not always justify an agency's bypassing the notice and comment process. Far from it. Instead, the agency must, at the very least, identify specific reasons why, in the environment of regulation, the ongoing pandemic constituted good cause. The mandate does not do that. That's it for today, Thursday, September 12th, 2024. I'm coming to you from the once great state of California. See you next time. Work on your attention span.